The question arises with regard to the Rambam's choice, the illustration. Suddenly that is assuming significance in our eyes as we study the Rambam. Because the Rambam did see fit to give an illustration of someone that really reflects the capacity to be a mochel, to be forgiving. And I think we all should remember that that's a very serious virtue, and contrarily, the inability to forgive is a serious defect. So he cites the case of Avraham, that Avraham forgave Avimelech. As we noted, at first glance anyways, it seems problematic. Because on a certain level, one has to ask the question, who really sinned against who? We see that Avimelech complains to Avraham. One can raise the question of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol, that you're not allowed to put a stumbling block before a blind person. So to go around with a woman and that you're married to, a married woman, and create a public impression that you're not married would be tantamount to creating a stumbling block and would be prohibited. You're not allowed to do that. Interestingly enough, it gives us a clear understanding as to why a married woman has to look like a married woman. Modesty, covering the hair, to... I'm not saying that if a woman went around and didn't cover the hair or didn't create the impression that automatically she's ensnaring people, because there's a lot of other steps that you have to assume. As long as she makes it clear if anybody should approach her that she's married, so then fine. But you clearly understand how seriously wrong it would be to go around publicly in social situations, as men sometimes do, married men, because a married man could just, if he's wearing they all don't wear a wedding band, some do, could just remove it, whatever. There certainly would be an inyan of placing a stumbling block before the blind. Thus you see that Avimelech had his argument. He had his defense. And it's not easy to understand why it was condemned in terms of the action itself, unless it was a lie. But God says, I know that you did this with clean hands. So God is not denying that. It's a big challenge to understand why Avimelech deserved to be punished. However, we try to explain that sometimes it's difficult for a person to forgive, even if the other person wasn't intentionally trying to harm him, but due to the nature of the harm that was sustained. So that there are certain things where it doesn't really make that much difference to you. You could see that in the case of your child. If somebody hurt your child, or in a hospital, or the child was taken from the place, and you thought it was a kidnap, was separated. If your child was separated from you, and you had agonizing days or weeks thinking that the child was kidnapped or dead, and it turned out, after all is said and done, that it was not anybody's fault. It was a mistake. Then it may be very difficult to forgive, because you're not really interested anymore whether it was an accident or not. It's being able to let go of the pain that you suffered. That's essentially how we approached it, that in the case of Avraham, the ability to forgive has to do with accepting the fact that there are times, there are situations where you have to suffer too. And the inability to forgive has to do with the distorted ego, that you can't tolerate the idea that you have been put through certain things and it's irrelevant to you. And you see that when people do suffer, there are certain types of things, they don't really care, they're not willing to listen, they don't really care what your answer is. This can't happen, this shouldn't happen, this shouldn't happen to me. Fine. However, the question arises, still, if the Rambam is looking for an example, and usually when you're looking for an example, you want the best example. It seems to us that there is a better example. In terms of the greatness of the capacity to forgive, at first glance, it would seem that nobody expresses that more than Yosef. given the situation that he was subjected to, and here it was not a question of an accident or a misunderstanding. Here he had been subjected to the worst possible abuse by his own brothers, to the extent that they were prepared to kill him. And he pleaded with them. The Torah makes it clear, not at the time that it's happening, but later on in retrospect, when the brothers are recalling that we didn't listen to him when he pleaded with us. And they had just about reached the point of killing him, and they didn't kill him, so they sold him as a slave, which was tantamount to a psychological destruction. For all intents and purposes, what they thought they were doing was ending his life. So the most that they could possibly say is, we didn't physically kill you. But other than that, there's no excuse. And because of circumstances, because it just goes to show you that the power of man is limited. One should never overestimate the power of man. You see that from that case. It's hard to imagine doing anything more. Putting a person in a worse situation. Everything's against you. The whole situation is stacked against you. And then Yosef emerged. Not just that he emerged, but he became the ruler over all of Egypt. And now the tide has turned. Everybody should be honest and put yourself in the Yosef situation. It's you. You've been subjected to that terrible humiliation, to that terrible treatment, not at the hands of strangers. And it's also the psychological humiliation, because they say, we'll see what happens to his dreams, the dreamer. So it's the psychological humiliation, but that seems to pale in comparison with the actual treatment. And it doesn't turn out like they said. It turns out like you. Your dreams weren't crazy dreams. They were real nevuah. And God is with you, and you work out the situation. And now you're the ruler over all of Egypt. And there's a famine throughout the world. And you sit and wait, because you know sooner or later they're going to come. And they come. And this is like, isn't that the ultimate fantasy, that anybody who would nurture any kind of feelings against an enemy, wouldn't that be a great position to be in? And here they are. And you're Yosef, and they're the brothers. Let's redo the story from the vantage point of ordinary people. Put yourself in that situation, and let's see how that's a great starting point for a story. It has to be pointed out, some may say, that Yosef, to the contrary, he didn't forgive. He exacted his pound of flesh, because it is true that he subjected the brother to a great deal of anguish. He had them arrested, he gave them the sense of insecurity, that they couldn't come down unless he even subjected his father to a great deal of suffering, with the demand that he bring down Binyamin. And then he accused them of stealing his cup, and so on and so forth. Now, on the surface, a person might say that was revenge. We've gone through the story at length, and it's very obvious that it's not the case. First of all, it can't be considered revenge, because if so, why would he hurt his father? He didn't blame his father for what happened. If anything, it would be limited to the brothers. Secondly, you see, on a number of occasions, he pauses because he has to cry. The Torah points out that he goes into the other room and he cries, because it caused him a great deal of pain to do what he was doing. So as we explained, everything Yosef did was based upon his interpretation of what God was requiring of him because of the dreams, and that his essential mission was to be the instrument through which the brothers would do tshuva. And he had no personal enjoyment out of what he was doing. To the contrary, it caused him pain. But that's what he had to do. And this is proven by the fact that as soon as the final requirement that Yehuda made his final appeal and was willing to put himself in the place of Binyamin, and we explained how that all ties back to the original sin of the brothers. At that point in time, he didn't waste another second, and he revealed himself. He made himself known. And as soon as he does that, he immediately does everything he can to reassure them that he will not take any revenge against them. To the contrary, they should come down to Egypt, and he'll take care of them, and he'll sustain them and the whole family, and he keeps his word. Interestingly enough, 17 years later, after Yaakov died and he's buried, then the brothers are concerned. And it mentions that they, according to Rashi, that they noticed a certain change, a minor change, in his closeness to them. He sort of distanced himself from them, and they, because of their own fears, were concerned that he now was going to take revenge. Then you have another tearful encounter, where they approach him again, and in fact, they make up a lie, and say that the father instructed them, left a will, a message from the grave, so to speak, to instruct Yosef not to take revenge. But again, Yosef cries when he hears them saying that, because that was the furthest thing from his mind. He had no intention of taking revenge, and he again reassures them that he'll protect them and take care of them. And it says this time he spoke to their heart, and he completely removed that fear. He didn't want them to even have any fear that he would ever take revenge. This, the fact that the brothers, after all those years, would still have fears of possible revenge, would indicate, we can deduce from that, they knew what they had done to him. That they felt guilty enough, or that what they had done was so serious, that even after all these years, maybe Yosef was just waiting for his father to die, because they knew the relationship with his father. And they were not completely convinced, in spite of all the hospitality that he had shown to them all along, they still harbored fear. Thus we would say that Yosef was mochel, complete mechila, complete forgiveness. And therefore my question would be, why wouldn't the Rambam select Yosef as being the case? It's being suggested that there are other factors that are at work in the Yosef situation. One of them being that when all this happened, Yosef saw it as being the unfolding of a divine plan. And that's what he tells the brothers, indeed, that there was a purpose in all of this, and it had to do with saving the entire nation. So this was a vital element. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that you absolve the person from responsibility. He wasn't saying that. But it's much easier for a person to accept certain things when you could see what the purpose was. That there was a tremendous benefit as a result of it. This would be different than Abraham. Abraham, it's true, received gifts, but alright, so that has a certain amount of significance, but it doesn't make that much of a difference in the big picture. It's not the same as being able to recognize that something that you went through is of tremendous significance in God's scheme of things. And you look back and you say, this was the will of God to enable me to play a significant role, a major role, in the unfolding of the divine providence with regard to the Jewish people. I want to make clear what the ground rules of this discussion are. Someone might be troubled and say, perhaps I'm making too much of the whole thing. Maybe the Rambam was just searching for an example of someone who has the power to forgive, and he just happened to think about Abram, and that's it. And the failure to mention Yosef doesn't mean that he regarded Abram as the greater case. Maybe he was just focused on Abram at that point and just didn't think about Yosef. That approach is rejected, because the Rambam wrote all of his works, and especially the Mishnah Torah, with the greatest precision. And therefore, he thought about everything very, very carefully and weighed every issue. And in a situation like this, where he's looking for an example, even his examples, his illustrations, he would choose the optimum one. So there are good grounds. Of course, one can always say, maybe in this case, it slipped his mind. That's very hard to say, but we have to operate on a principle. And the principle we're operating with is that the Rambam was the master. He knew every case. Not just in the five books, but in all of Tanakh. So when he chose an example, he thought it through. And if there was a better example than Abraham, he would have chosen that one. So those are the ground rules. And as I said, we're trying to go inside of his mind, his reasoning. Well, not his mind so much, but the facts which the cases present. And see assuming that he had both cases in front of him, which he did, why he would opt for the Avram case. I'm going to suggest a possibility, possible explanation as to why the case of Yosef would not be as compelling as the case of Avraham. The basis for our assumption that everything that Yosef did with regard to the brothers, the treatment, the harsh treatment of the brothers, that it was not done out of a sense of revenge, but rather was done because of a divine mandate, is based upon a pasuk. In chapter 42 in Bereishis, pasuk tes. That is a crucial pasuk, and I'm basing myself on the interpretation of Rabbi Chait. If you take a look at the surrounding psukim, it talks about when the brothers came down. And Yosef was there. He knew that eventually the brothers would come down. And he placed himself at the point where custom, so to speak, I assume, where all the foreigners would be coming into the country and have to undergo some type of a check, a security check or whatever. And then it tells us that Yosef saw his brothers and he recognized them. And he pretended to be a stranger, not that he didn't make himself known to them. And he spoke harshly with them. Then it says in Pasuk Tes that Yosef remembered the dreams that he had dreamed regarding them, and Yosef then accuses them of being spies. So on the surface, there doesn't seem to be a connection between the two. What does the fact that he remembered the dreams have to do with the accusation that they were spies? According to Rabbi Chait's interpretation, it meant, if you remember the two dreams, the first, both dreams depict Yosef in a position of control, of being the ruler, supremacy. And the difference is that the first one has to do with their bundles. It shows that their bundles, they gathered their bundles, and all the bundles surrounded Yosef's and bowed down to Yosef's bundle. So that was the indication that he would rule in the sense of having the economic power. That reflected the economic situation. The second one was the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to him. So the interpretation of that, the stars reflect the idea of being luminaries, greatness. You know, you'll shine as a star in heaven. That is to say that he would not just rule over them in terms of economic, but he would have the spiritual leadership. He would be the leader in terms of the system of Judaism, the intellectual, the spiritual leadership. Now, however, so what's the idea that he remembered the dreams? At this point in time, he discovered something new, or he made a new connection. And that is, because he was now in a situation where the first dream was fulfilled. Interestingly enough, the economic basis of life in Canaan was herding, they had animals, the sheep. It wasn't an agricultural situation. Here in Egypt, it was an agricultural phenomenon. So that part was coming true. But what he recognized was that there would be a connection between the two. That the means by which he would establish the spiritual ascendancy would be their spiritual guide, their spiritual leader would be through the economic. That now in effect, he had been given that tool. They were completely dependent upon him economically. But the dream was also saying that he should utilize the economic power that he held over them in order to effectuate their tshuva, which meant that he was the one who was being given the power over them in a spiritual sense. This factor alone shows that he really was not being given the option of simply having an ordinary reaction to the brothers. The option was determined already for him. The manner in which he was supposed to act was a result of a command of God. This was Nevuah, this was prophecy. According to his interpretation of the dreams, the dream itself contained within it the manner in which he should utilize the situation. That's why immediately he accused them of being spies. The accusation of being spies is related to the dream. It's not that Yosef decided to do this on his own. Thus, his reaction in this particular situation was already determined for him by God. Now, of course, he didn't have to listen to God. I'm not getting into that. But it's quite a different story when you're in a situation and you've been hurt, and now the situation's reversed. It's completely up to you. I mean, you have the power to act any way you want. Nobody's telling you what to do. But if God should intervene and tell you specifically what to do, so that already determines how you're going to be acting in that situation. It was predetermined for him, so to speak. Of course, it requires greatness not to follow your emotions, but he was being told through the medium of the dream to utilize this opportunity to exercise his mission of being the Mashgiach, their guide, the ruler in the spiritual sense. And the objective of the ruler in the spiritual sense is to effectuate the change, to lead them back to the path of tshuva rather than to inflict any punishment. Of course, in the course of doing so, they had to experience pain, but everything was being done in a very controlled kind of a way. So that's one of the factors that's different. Other factors that are different, I think, have been mentioned. It's not a pure case of one in which a person's need for revenge would be as tested due to other factors. Those factors being that, as has been mentioned, did Yosef himself do tshuva? The story is introduced with the defects of the three characters. And each one of the parties had to do tshuva. Of course, first and foremost is Yosef. Hunar, that Yosef was youthful. He had vanity. He spoke Lashon Hara. He brought back evil reports about the brothers. So he clearly was involved in bringing about what took place. And the question then is, did Yosef do tshuva? Did Yosef achieve a recognition of his own role, of his own sins? Because once he did tshuva, once he understood, and it has to be, the answer is yes. Because if not, then he would have acted differently. Yosef retained his righteousness. So if he did tshuva, it means that he was able to look back and see his defects, how he had contributed to the situation. And if that's the case, he would have to look at the brothers in an entirely different light. Now, how are we supposed to look at the brothers? Are we supposed to look at them as the story would make it appear, on a superficial level? On a superficial level, they look like the lowest of the low. And then you wonder, how can brothers do this over something trivial? And the answer is, that's not the case. They were all tzaddikim. They were all great people. And it's difficult for us, it's always a challenge, to acknowledge that these are great people, and yet to say that great people made a mistake. Because the danger is that we project. We tend to judge them from our own vantage point. And that's a serious, serious mistake. You cannot judge. It's a premise of the Torah. We have this from the Torah Sheval Peh. We can't evaluate the characters over here on the basis of what the Torah is presenting. There's just no way it could be done. So you can't study Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, the matriarchs, all the people that you encounter in the Torah cannot be studied. You can't come to any conclusion on the basis purely of what's being stated over here. Certain premises that come to us through the Masorah, that a certain person was a tzaddik. And given that he's a tzaddik, you have to approach what's being described in a certain way. That doesn't mean that these people never sin, but the sin of a tzaddik is not the sin of an ordinary person. There are a number of factors that differentiate the case of Yosef. And it is it's certainly great of him to be able to be mochel, but you also have to consider, as we've said, the fact that he contributed to it. And he looked at the sin of the brothers in a different light. He knew the situation. He knew they were tzaddikim. He also understood their fears. He understood that they weren't just acting out of their emotions. But that, if the way we study it, if you reflect upon it, the brothers were extremely fearful that Yosef was plotting to dominate them and to take over. That's what they said. Are you going to be ruling over us? Are you going to be the king over us? So there was a tremendous gap and a tremendous misunderstanding had taken place. That is, that for the brothers to do this, they took very, very seriously. The fact that Yaakov, that Yosef appeared to them to be someone who was plotting to take over the future of the movement. He had the complete approval of Yaakov. Yaakov was on his side. He had managed, in their eyes, to deceive Yaakov. And the dreams themselves indicated to them that he had very powerful desire to rule over them, not just economically, but also spiritually as well. So they looked at Yosef as being someone who presented the greatest possible danger. Now, if you understand that, if you look at it that way, if you look at it from that framework, and you must look at it from that framework, because if not, then what's the point of bringing them back to tshuva? If they're not tzaddikim, if they're not righteous people, who are going to play a role, who have not been written out of the book. Each one of them is going to be a leader of a tribe, and they are going to play a role in the history of the Jewish people. So then the whole basis for revenge changes. It's not a personal affront anymore. I think you can also add in the factor that has been mentioned, that even on a purely psychological level, I'm not saying that Yosef derived any satisfaction from the pain that they went through. It seems that he didn't, because he cries. But again, the need for revenge is removed. Once they went through all that pain and suffering, and they were brought down, so to speak, so that changes the entire dynamics of the situation. David HaMelech, when he was running away from Shaul, so he ran away to the kingdom of Gath, and he feigned insanity. And then the word got back to the king that his big enemy, his arch enemy, King David. But when he found out the condition that he was in, he thought he really was insane. So he said, "Hachasar Meshugayim ani? Am I lacking in Meshugayim? I have enough Meshugayim in my own palace." This is a little bit sarcastic. Meaning to say that the desire for revenge is against the figure. Psychologically, you have in mind the type of person who sinned, the arrogance of the person who sinned against you. But when that person is not there anymore, even they're physically alive, even for example, you conjure up some of the Nazis and all the torture that they inflicted, and everybody's filled with a rage, and if we can only get our hands on them, you want to tear them apart. But that's when you see these people in their prime, when they were torturing the Jews. But now, if you see someone who's a frail old man and he's a senile, completely senile, does not partake of any of the elements, you may despise the person, but you just wouldn't satisfy you to take revenge, because there's no revenge. Revenge is that the person is you're the same person that hurt me, and now I want you to see what you're getting in return. But it presupposes it's the same person. It's not the same person who you're taking revenge against. The enjoyment is not there. The enjoyment of revenge is that very same person with all of his arrogance. Hitler in his prime, with all of his arrogance and hatred for the Jews, that's the one that you're going to inflict the revenge upon. Bring him down. But it's not the same person anymore. There's just no enjoyment there. You know, he's not a fitting subject for revenge. I think that's another factor in the Yosef situation. The whole situation's changed. They're not the same people anymore. So if you add together all these factors, as again, even though it is to the credit of Yosef that he followed the dictates of what the Hashkacha required and demanded, still, it's a different situation. In the case of Avraham, you've got the mighty king Avimelech, and he's there, and he inflicted this upon you, and Your feeling just might be, look, I'm not going to do anything, but I'm not going to pray for you. You know, a certain coldness. You're asking me to identify with your problem? All the elements that would bring about the desire for the revenge, or for the failure, the unwillingness to forgive, were in place. So I'm just suggesting that that the situation is different. And it's complex, it's not simplistic. We're going to go ahead now, skip a few halachos, and come to another aspect. Because the Rambam then describes about rebuking a person, the obligation to rebuke a person, even if they didn't sin against you, but purely for their benefit. That is a Jew who commits an avera, or a Jew who's going astray. So there we learn that every Jew has a responsibility for the well-being of his fellow Jew. And just as if a person is in physical danger, you're not allowed to stand idly by the blood of your brother. You have an obligation to intercede to help him. So too, in the arena, which is even more significant, in terms of their soul, in terms of their so-called spiritual life, if a fellow Jew is engaged in behaviors that are very destructive from a spiritual point of view, you're not allowed to stand idly by. You have an obligation to rebuke the person. We're not going to be taking that up right now. That's a very complicated subject. But let's continue with the type of rebuke that we're talking about that's based upon lo sisna sechishal b'levecha, that you may not hate your brother. Based upon personal, interpersonal problems. Altercations, as they say. And that is, let's say somebody offended you, insulted you. Are you always under an obligation to rebuke? What about a situation where that's not the desired course? Let's take a look at Halacha Tes. That's 9. So the Rambam says, one whose fellow, a person's fellow, sinned against him. And he didn't want to rebuke him. Let's say somebody insulted you, offended you. I'm sure we all face these situations from time to time. He didn't want to rebuke him, and he didn't want to speak to him. Doesn't want to speak to this person. Because the sinner, the offender, is a very base kind of person. The Rambam used the term hedyot b'yosef. Hedyot, meaning to say someone who's extremely boorish. Now, I think we've all encountered there are certain kind of people that you just can't talk to. And even if you go about it in a nice way, especially if it's something where you're complaining. You're complaining. You can imagine, you've all been there. And someone offended you, and you just want to bring it to their attention, and as soon as they hear where you're going, they start to, you know, push you aside and, or insult you even more. You just can't talk. And you've had this experience. It could have been with strangers where you complained about how you were treated, or in a store or whatever, or it could be with friends. And to the contrary, it gets even worse. They start to abuse you and insult you, and you walk away saying, you just can't talk to this person. So I'm sure we all know people about whom we could say, just can't talk to this person. Now, the question is, what if you are offended or insulted by that person? Let's say the person who insulted you is the kind of person that you know very well. It's very tough to talk to this person. Now, you may say, well, if that's the case, then why should you even be offended if the person is a Jewish boy? Well, yeah, but it's more complicated than that. There are people, given the fact that we have emotions, that you're bothered. You are bothered, they offended you, it hurts you, and you would prefer to talk to them, but you know very well that they're very tough to talk to, so you don't want to talk to them. The Rambam goes even further and says, or sometimes the person's got a mental problem. So it's a borderline. Sometimes it's a behavioral phenomenon. They're, you know, the person has got a defect, or sometimes the person has a more serious situation. He's not all there, as they say. Now again, you might say, but well, if that's the case, then why should it bother you? And the answer is that it bothers you. Look, a person that's certified and insane, of course, probably you won't be offended. If you walk into a psycho ward, and people that are completely out of reality, if the person insults you, you don't take it personally. Interesting. Because you attribute it purely to his illness. Well, if that's the case, then why should you ever take it personally? Because you can always ask yourself a question. Here's a surefire way to avoid being hurt. Whenever someone offends you, ask yourself a question. Is it true? or is it not true? Is the thing they're saying about you true or not true? If it's true, so what are you upset with them? For noticing something which is true? Yeah? If someone points out that you have a stain on your dress, so what do you immediately do? You look to see. If it's true, you're not going to get angry at them. It's the stain. On the other hand, if it's not true, so they're making it up. If it's not true, so then why are they insulting you? Oh, because they have a bad emotion. So if they have a bad emotion, so that's an illness, so why should you get upset? Why are you so upset that this person has a spiritual disease? Why does it bother you so much that this person has a problem? When a person complains about an insult, and they're protesting that it's not true, so why did the person say it? Because that person is sick. So if that person is sick, why are you so angry? You should be sympathetic. Generally speaking, when you hear about a certain person that's sick, you go pay him a visit. Be home. Yeah, are you angry at a person because they're sick? So why, if you come to the conclusion that what they're saying is a result of their sickness, so why are you hurt? Why are you so angry at this person that they're sick? This lesson has to be repeated because of its importance. Again, if somebody offends you, before you go off and get all excited, think about it carefully and honestly, or ask an independent person. The question has to be asked. You have to look at it objectively. Maybe they notice something about you, a defect. So you learn something. If it's true, so why are you angry at them? It's something that's true about you. So they've noticed it. It's good that they noticed it and pointed it out to you. They've done you a favor. Maybe that wasn't their intention, but you're a gainer. Because now you can work on a defect. Or you say, well, it's not true. So if it's not true, then why would a person try to hurt you by fabricating something? By imputing something to you? It's because they have a defect. They have an emotional defect, which is a serious illness. Well, if that's the case, so then you should look at them as having a sickness and be sympathetic. Why should you be angry at them? Because they're sick. That's a very interesting thing when you put it that way. Why do people get angry at other people whom they regard as being sick? Because in all these cases, that's what you say, that person is sick. But you say it with such anger. But why are you angry that this person is sick? The answer is being suggested is because you're angry at them even though they're sick, because they don't think that they're sick. Because they put themselves on a high plane. However, let's ask ourselves the question. If they're sick, and not only are they sick, but they're not aware of it, and they think that they're moral judges, so that's an even greater sickness. So as soon as you point that out, you're saying that the sickness is a very severe sickness, so why do you hate a person for suffering from such a severe sickness? The craziness of the human condition is that we are so insecure that even if we regard it as not being true, the mere fact that somebody else could say this about us is so threatening to our ego that we ascribe reality to what somebody else says, even though logically we're saying that this person is crazy, this person is sick, and there's no basis for it, and still we're offended. That is the weakness. It's rooted in the need for the approval of other people. And that's where this emotional necessity for retaliation that takes place. A tzaddik should never get insulted. But that's a tzaddik. Which means to say that a person whose emotions are fully in line with the truth, with the object of reality, will not get insulted. Even if he's publicly embarrassed. Theoretically, and this is a theoretical construct, a person who was, so to speak, perfectly attuned to reality would not get insulted and would not get offended. That is to say, if somebody else says something about them, they would approach it from this standpoint. If it's true, so then they're only concerned with their own defects. Thank you very much, and I'll work on it. If it's false, so they don't feel bad. There's nothing to feel bad about. Then the only thing is, the other person's defect. If the other person has a defect, that the person embarrasses somebody publicly. That wouldn't bother you at all. That's his defect. Now, that's a very high level to be on, and obviously, even you can't insult someone and tell them, well, it's your fault, because why do you allow yourself to get insulted? You can't do that, because you have to treat people on the level that they're on. So that's a very compelling emotion. Everybody partakes of it. So you have a situation where the person that offended you is one with whom you really don't want to talk, or you can't talk. You know people like that. You just can't talk to these people. So what's the halacha? So the Rambam says, Umacha lo belima. And he forgives this person in his heart. Velo sitmo. And did not harbor anger. Velo achicha. And he doesn't rebuke him. So the Rambam says, Areza midas chasidus. This is a level of piety. Lo hikpida Torah, ela alamas tema. The Rambam is saying that it's not inherently required that you rebuke the person, because that's what the pasuk says, that you may not hate your brother in his heart. And the obligation to rebuke is in order to resolve the issue, so you won't have hatred. But if a person was offended, and in your heart, you forgive the person, you don't bear hatred. As we said, tzaddikim, they love them. Tzaddikim are insulted. People insult them, they don't take it to heart. Deflect it. It has to be genuine. I mean, a lot of people will say, it doesn't bother me. But assuming that it's sincere, so then there's no requirement to rebuke. Now, I would imagine, if that's the case, that this would apply to anyone. The Rambam is just giving us an example. An example about where you don't want to approach the person, because that person is very difficult to talk to. But one could deduce from here that it would apply in any case, even if the person is easy to talk to. If a person insults you, you have a right to think it over and be very honest, assuming that you forgive the person. You don't bear any ill will that could be construed as hatred, so that you don't have to rebuke them. I think that makes perfect sense. I want to make clear, rebuke is legitimate. That is, in this situation, if you're offended, and most people can't just forgive and get over it without any kind of a explanation. So the Torah is realistic. This is the way we're constructed. But there is a mechanism by which we can get past this. And that is, you explain to the other person, and hopefully if the other person is just and reasonable, that person will apologize. And once you have an apology, you can be mochel. So it's not a matter of revenge to rebuke somebody. No, but the person is deserving of a rebuke. That's for sure. This person deserves a rebuke, because they did the wrong thing, and you're bothered by it. So that's the way we should function. Bear in mind that the victim over here is in spiritual danger. The person who's been offended is in great danger, because if indeed you do harbor hatred, you're in violation. So before saying, no, I forgave him, and I'm not going to, because I don't want to rebuke him, be careful whether you're just saying it because you're too fearful. You don't want to rock the boat. Or because you really did overcome it. You have to really know yourself. But there's nothing wrong with rebuking the person. What the Rambam has said, though, is that there are cases where it's impossible to rebuke this person. So then he says, if that's the case, if you forgive the person in your heart. From this, I'm deducing that it's not just in that situation, but in every situation. You have to say that the only obligation to rebuke stems from the prohibition of hating. But even if the person is a reasonable person, if you've thought it over, and you want to be on a higher madriga, you want to get it out of your system without having to rebuke, so certainly that's midas chasidus. I don't see why not. The other kind of rebuke, where a person is doing a sin, or the person is straying from the path and hurting himself, you have an inherent obligation to rebuke. That has nothing to do with how you feel. And you can't be mochel. That's not something where you can forgive. That's an obligation you have to your fellow man to see to it that they don't stray from the good. So that's a completely different thing. However, this is the question that was raised. What if you find yourself in this situation where you've been offended, and the person who offended you fits into this category of being exceedingly boorish, or someone that you really can't talk to? It's someone you can't approach. So the Rambam has said, well, if you forgive him in your heart, and so on, that's very good. But let's say you can't forgive him in your heart either. So you're sort of in a lose-lose situation. It bothers you, and you have the anger, and you can't forgive. At the same time, you can't confront this person. Well, one can find many reasons. The Rambam gives us an example. There can be other reasons. Let's say the person that offended you is sick, in kind of a serious way, and you can't do it right now because you could jeopardize the person. So, I mean, there's always these illustrations. You could always find cases where there are reasons why you can't engage in ocheach tochiach, you can't engage in rebuke, and you can't overcome it either. But you would be able to overcome it if you could speak to the person. That is to say that if somebody could talk to this person and make this person manageable, then you're saying if I could speak to this person and I could hear this person give their explanation or offer their apology, then I'd forgive them. But right now I can't. What's the halacha in that case? To answer this question, we gave two formulations. So to speak, a hakira, you know. There are two ways you can analyze the phenomena. It says, Lo sisna sechicha b'levecha. You shall not hate your fellow in your heart. Hocheach tochiach samisecha. You shall rebuke. Now there are two ways you can learn it theoretically. One is saying it's an absolute prohibition to hate. Now, that means you're not allowed to hate, period. Period, you're not allowed to hate, and if you hate, you're in violation. Oh, but the Torah is then giving you advice. So what am I supposed to do? I'm a human being, and people have emotions, and you can't control all these emotions, so the Torah is saying, then go rebuke. But these are two separate things. One is not contingent upon the other. That is to say, the obligation to rebuke does not qualify the prohibition of hating. Or else we could say, no, the two are intimately connected. The obligation of rebuking actually conditions and defines the very prohibition of hatred. That is to say, as follows, it's a totally different way of looking at it. The Torah recognizes that there are certain situations where a person will be attacked, verbally, or offended, emotionally attacked, offended. So then, the Torah is telling you that there are two paths that you could take. We're not talking about the initial emotion. And you're not responsible for your initial visceral emotion. That's not what we're talking about. Because that's not something within your control. But after the initial wears off, and then you have to make a decision what you're going to do about it, so then there are two pathways. One is the pathway of hatred. To build it up, to store it, to harbor it in your heart. That's one pathway. And that's what the Rambam has described is the way of the wicked. That's a decision. The Torah saying is, you're not allowed to take that path because there's a different path. That path is the path of resolution. And the path of resolution is through the medium of hocheach tochiach, to rebuke. That is, you confront the person in an intelligent way. You gotta use a cycle. Not in an offensive kind of way. You confront the person. The person responds to you, apologizes, you forgive. That's the pathway. So therefore, the prohibition of lo sisna, of not hating, is only where you're negating. It's your failure to utilize the mechanism of hochacha. When you're negating the appropriate mechanism of the resolution of the conflict, and therefore you choose instead to take the pathway of hatred, that's the prohibition we're talking about. It follows from that the only time you're in a state of prohibition is when you've made a conscious choice that you're going to take the method of hatred. And you're going to negate the method of rebuke. But that presupposes that the possibility of rebuke is in existence because you're a human being. But if the possibility of rebuke is not in existence and you remain in a state of hatred not because you've chosen that course but simply because you have no other way of dealing with the problem, that's not the prohibition. Now, if you take a look at the Rambam, I think he supports this way of looking at it, that the prohibition of hatred is only where there's the possibility of rebuke and you negate it, and you choose instead a path which the Torah is completely opposed to. Because the Rambam says in this situation where you don't rebuke the person, because he's the kind of person you can't speak to. Well, because he has a mental problem and you can't even talk to him. So he says that if he forgives him in his heart and doesn't harbor revenge and doesn't rebuke him, he says, this is me, this chassidus. This is a degree of piety. That proves that forgiving him in this situation is a degree of piety. But if the Rambam meant to tell us that in this situation you have no choice, that if you don't forgive him, you're going to be in violation, then it wouldn't be a degree of piety. The Rambam would have simply said, okay, you don't have to rebuke him, but you're obligated. You're obligated to forgive him in your heart. By saying that if he forgives him in his heart, this is piety, it implies that if he doesn't forgive him in his heart, he's lacking in midas chassidus. But in terms of the violation of lo sisna, it would appear that he's not in violation. That is to say, the Torah did not demand the impossible. The Torah recognizes that we have emotions, but we also have to use our intelligence to deal with those emotions in an intelligent manner. But that presupposes that the option is there. If the option is not there through no fault of your own, and you want to make up, you don't want to harbor anger, but in order to do so, you need to be able to speak to that person, then the unavailability of that option, if that is the, then the reason why you're in a state of hatred is simply because that option is not available to you, not because of a deliberate choice that you've made, then I would say you're not in violation. In a case where you're offended and you rebuke them and they apologize and you still hate them, well, the Rambam is saying two things. First of all, when that situation occurs, you're obliged to forgive them, to be mocha. You have that obligation to your fellow man. Because in that, there is another situation over here. You have to bear in mind that a new reality is being created as you go through the process. The new reality that's being created is that someone who started out as an offender is now coming before you entreating you, in need of your forgiveness. Your inability to forgive that person is cruelty. That's what the Rambam said. So you now, because of this whole situation, because you went through the process of rebuke, you now made this person into someone who's entreating you for forgiveness. So your failure to forgive him renders you into someone who's cruel. Putting that aside, however, if after all this is done and you did rebuke him, and the person did respond appropriately and did ask for your forgiveness, and you still hate the person, you're in violation. Now you're in violation of the biblical command of Moses and Zechichah B'Lavecha. So you have a serious problem. You have to work on yourself like you have to work on yourself for any other Aveira. That's a sin. Now, the only thing, we're not talking, if you're going to say that there's nothing I can do about it, it's just beyond my control, that's like anything else, then that's for God to decide. We're not held responsible for those things outside of our control. We're not talking about that. We're just answering the question. And that is that if you go through the process, the prescription for resolution, which the Torah demands that we take, then two things happen. If this person accepts what you're saying, accepts it, and then entreats you for forgiveness, you must forgive. Failure to forgive would render you into a cruel person and would be lacking in the characteristic of being someone who's a forgiver, who's mochel. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you still retain the hatred in your heart, you're in clear violation of the commandment of lo sisna sachicha b'levecha. You know, I hate your brother in your heart. The question is being raised with regard to what we said, that when a person sins against his fellow, so the offended party is not allowed to hate, and they're obligated to rebuke. And there's a scenario, if everything goes right, then the offender will apologize. When that happens, the appropriate thing is for the victim to forgive. That's the ideal scenario. In terms of the tshuva, in terms of the sinner, if a person insults another individual or harms another individual in any way, as we've learned, you're obligated to do tshuva. You have to repent for any sin that you did, whether it's a sin between man and God or a sin between man and man. However, in the case between man and man, there's a little bit of a wrinkle. There's a little bit of a complication. It seems to me that the path of tshuva is more difficult if you sinned against your fellow man, as opposed to a case where you sinned against God. Meaning to say where it's just between you and God, it doesn't affect anybody else. In such a case, all you have to do is to beseech God. You have to do tshuva, repent, and confess, etc., but it's just before God. In the case where you sinned against your fellow man, that's required, but that can only be done. There's a precondition. The precondition is that you make amends with the one against whom you sinned, the one whom you hurt. And that is not so simple. Because the Rambam states in Hilchos Tshuva, the laws of Tshuva in chapter 2, that it's not enough to just restore the loss. This is in chapter 2, Halacha 9, where he says, Averos shebein adam lachavero, sins between man and man. For example, one who wounds, inflicts damage on his friend, or one who cursed his friend, or he stole from him, or the like, any type of harm that he inflicted upon him. He is not forgiven, never forgiven, until he returns to his friend what he owes him, viratzeil, and he has to pacify him. That's the tough part. It's easy to send the check, but he has to confront him and pacify him. Even though he returned the money that he owes him, he's still obliged to pacify him and to ask him for forgiveness. And even if he only hurt him with words, that is, there was no objective damage, it was just offended the person verbally, he's got to pacify him. And then he adds, and he's got to continue to entreat him until he forgives him, which means that if it doesn't come quickly or easily, that doesn't let him off the hook. He's got to continue and entreat the person until he forgives him. If the person did not want to forgive him, so then he's supposed to bring a group of three people of his friends, and they should entreat him and request. If the person was not pacified, he brings a second group and a third group. So this is a very extensive prescription. It's very, very difficult. You're dealing with an individual who lacks the virtue of being a mochel. Yesterday we learned that a person, when offended and then apologized to, pacified, should accept it. The ideal is that people should be forgiving, quick to forgive. Kasha lichos v'noach l'ratzos. That's the ideal. Very hard to get angry, very difficult to make you angry, slow to anger, quick to forgive. That's the ideal. If after sending three groups of his friends, the person still doesn't want to forgive, manicho, the Rambam says, you just drop it, v'holech lo, and leave him, v'zeh shelo mochal hu achote, and the one who did not forgive, he is the sinner. So, the failure to forgive in a situation, and this is after many attempts at pacification, after all of this pacification, where you went to the person, and then you sent friends to him and so forth, the person still, he says three times, so then he becomes a sinner and you are absolved. Then you can do tshuva. Then you go before God. Because the fact that you didn't obtain his forgiveness is not because you retain a defect. It's not because you're unwilling to make amends. You've done everything that could possibly be done. And it's due to a defect in the other person. So, in that situation, that person doesn't have absolute control over your willingness and your desire to do tshuva. Then you can go before God, because you have not abandoned the injustice. You tried to rectify the injustice that was committed. And the only thing that's preventing it is a defect in the other person. Questions being raised with regard to forgiveness. Can we conceive of a situation where a person emotionally doesn't really feel like forgiving, but on the other hand is aware that there's an obligation to forgive? Can a person forgive? Would it be considered forgiveness if the person says that they forgive them, even though inwardly they don't feel that way? Is forgiveness an emotional state? Or no, it's not an emotional state. It perhaps is a certain attitude that you're prepared to assume, even though you don't feel that way emotionally. We must assume that a person has within himself the capacity or the power to become forgiving. For if it weren't the case, then the Rambam wouldn't say that the failure to forgive is a sin. The fact that he's saying it's a sin means that it's something which is in your control. It's not just an emotion which you could sit back and say, I'll wait until the emotion goes away. It seems that the approach to this, we have to ask, what exactly do we mean by forgiveness? But from what we've learned, that this whole thing originates in the prohibition against hatred. That there are two states. One state is where you harbor hatred in the heart. Then, after rebuke, and the person apologizes, you're supposed to forgive. So what would be considered a real situation of forgiveness, it would seem, is when you no longer harbor hatred in your heart. The question is whether that's an emotional state or whether that's a certain position or attitude that you're maintaining. Let's look at it from a different perspective. Let's say we're talking in a different framework, whether it be in the world of politics, in any competitive situation, where people do bear grudges, the way it works. That is, if you do me a favor, I owe you one. On the other hand, politicians will remember those people who double-cross them. And they just wait for an opportunity to get even. Or let's say you're taking into the world of gangsters. That's a big phenomenon over there. You can be on the good list, you can be on the bad list. So if you did something which got somebody angry, so you're on the bad list. And he's just waiting, he hasn't done anything perhaps, but you know that when the opportunity presents itself, he's going to get even with you, or try to get even with you. Now, let's say that you're in a situation like that, and you ask someone who's got a connection to this person, and who has some kind of a basis, a chip, so to speak. In other words, this person owes him something. And you ask him to intercede, and in exchange for whatever you did for him, that he should take you off the bad list, so to speak, off the hit list. So let's say the person agrees and he goes and whatever, after that person decides, for whatever reasons, to grant the favor and he takes you off the list. So would that be a reasonable model of forgiveness? That is, you're not allowed to harbor hatred. Now, harbor hatred means that you have a certain attitude towards this person, and you wish this person ill. And doesn't mean to say that you necessarily will do something, it could. So, it means that you maintain a certain attitude towards what you would like to see happen to this person. Let's say you say, I forgive you. I still feel hurt, whatever the case may be, but because of whatever the factors are, let's say it's a family situation, and it's dividing the family. So someone's interceded and asked you to please forgive, so that the family can go on. But it means you're making an agreement now. You're agreeing to forgive, you're agreeing to forgo whatever claims you had as a result of the injury that were sustained, and that's mechila. One can make the analogy with forgiving a debt, where you may not feel that way, but very often in life, somebody makes a case, a compelling argument, as to why they would really appreciate it if you would forgive someone a certain debt. And then you may do it for a separate reason. You want to collect the debt, but due to the overriding factor over here, you agree to forgive the debt. So it's not an emotional thing, it's a decision you've made that you are prepared to forgive the debt. Now I'm using that as an analogy, wherein you're acting one way, but your emotions are not necessarily the cause of why you're acting that way. According to this formulation, it is possible that one can forgive, even if your emotions are not in line, even if you're not feeling it that way, and I think that's even a higher degree of perfection, that you don't go along with the emotion. You have conquered the emotion, and you've made a decision that you're not going to be an enemy of that person. You're not going to harbor hatred, and you're not going to mistreat the person because of what was done for you. You're forgiving. That is to say, it'll be as though it didn't happen to you. You will treat the person in the same way as if this had never occurred. So while you may be having a tough time with that emotionally, and there may be another side to you which is saying, no, you shouldn't, that doesn't matter. As long as you overcome the emotion in terms of how you're going to act towards the other person. In my opinion, it is very similar to monetarily forgiving a debt. It has nothing to do with how you feel about the person or about the debt. Whatever the factors may be, once you have decided that it's not going to be collectible anymore, you're going to relinquish it. So too, whatever, there's a debt over here. That is, you had certain claims against the person because they offended you. You're not going to pursue those claims. You're going to relinquish. It's sort of relinquishing the element of negativity towards that person, which we call hatred of the heart. And you may not even be happy with that decision, but that's a decision, and you have integrity, and you'll stick to it. The Rambam we've just read concludes with, after mentioning that in an ordinary situation, it's enough that you beseech the person three times. However, he concludes that if it was his Rebbe, his teacher, who he offended and whose forgiveness he's seeking, he has to continue to entreat him even 1,000 times until the Rebbe is mochel, until the Rebbe forgives. Just to clarify certain aspects of what forgiving entails. Forgiving is, again, you relinquish any sense of entitlement to punishment, to punishing the other person, that the person should suffer certain consequences as a result of the fact that they offended you. You relinquish that. And you will not hold the person responsible, in much the same way as a debt. You forgive the debt. So you will not subject that person to any type of consequences. However, we've raised the question, how far does this go? Question has been raised, for example, let's say in a marriage, if one spouse cheated on the other. So very often, that breaks up the marriage. The person now wants to get divorced, the one who was cheated on. Let's assume that the one who did the cheating regrets it and wants to, you know, wants to be married, but strayed, and is now prepared to beg forgiveness and all of that. Would the offended party be obligated to forgive? And if they're obligated to forgive, would that mean that they really would be wrong if they said they're going to divorce them because of what they did? If they insisted that they're going to divorce them, wouldn't that mean that they're not forgiving them? And if you want to follow the prescription of Torah, it would seem, at first glance, that they're obligated to forgive, and therefore they can't divorce them if they truly forgive them. In the case we're discussing, the fact that one forgives a person does not mean that you have to go back to the same situation that you were in before. That is to say, it's perfectly reasonable for a person to forgive you. I forgive you. I recognize that you had weaknesses and whatever the case may be, and you were subjected to a temptation, and I'm not hating you in my heart, but I don't want to be married to you anymore. Because now that I know that you do these kinds of things, so I don't want to be married to a person that does these kinds of things. You're not forced to remain married to that person, and if you decided that you want to be divorced, that would not necessarily be an indication that you can't forgive. Forgiveness only means that you don't harbor hatred, desire for revenge, or anything the like. It would be another example. Let's say you have a friend and you go on some kind of a trip together. And as very often happens in life, in the course of being with another person in certain informal situations, let's say this person acted in a way that really hurted you and you were terribly disappointed. And it was something you didn't know about the person. So then you have the confrontation. And the person apologizes. And you forgive. But you may come to the conclusion that this is not the kind of person you want to go on trips with. As a result of what you discovered, it doesn't mean that if you forgive, you're prepared to put up with anything that this person does, or that you have to restore to the way it used to be. It could be that now that you've seen this about the person, you don't want to be. You're not obligated to be on the same level of friendship. That's not required in forgiveness. That's your choice. Forgiveness merely means that you're not harboring a desire to inflict, or that somebody should inflict, suffering on this person as a result of what was done to you. We're going to conclude with the next halacha in the Rambam, that's Yud, which is 10. He says it's prohibited for a person to be cruel and not to be pacified, but rather he should be easy to pacify, very difficult to anger. And when the person who sinned against him requests forgiveness, he should forgive b'lev shalem, with a full heart, with a nefesh chafetza, and with a positive attitude, a desire to forgive. That is certainly the ideal, that a person should be on the level where he does not, he's not so completely caught up in his own ego, in his own pettiness, in his own emotions, the overestimation, the magnification of one's own narcissistic situation. A person should be able to see it for what it is, and to recognize that in the big picture, a person should also have a sense of what's important in life, in the big picture, and the entire world shouldn't revolve around how things impact upon his emotions. And therefore should be able, when the person and the other person recognizes it, restoring it, it's an affront to your dignity. This person affronted your dignity, now the person's restoring your dignity, he's apologizing, he's recognizing that you have dignity and it was the wrong thing to do. That should be enough for you. That should be plenty, and you should be very, very happy. Happy that the person recognized it, and happy to be able to forgive someone. That's the ideal. And he says, even if this person caused them great pain and sinned a great deal against them. So the question as to what limit would there be, in which situations would you not be obligated to forgive, the Rambam is here saying that even if the person inflicted great suffering upon him, he should not take revenge, and he should not bear a grudge. And he says, this is the derech. This is the style of the Jews, of the Jewish people, Zera Yisrael, of the seed of Israel. The libam hanachon, and their correct heart. That is to say that the Jew, who's achieved the perfection of Judaism, is trained his emotions. His emotions are connected to that which is really important, and because of that, has the capacity to forgive. However, he says, but the Ovdei Kochavim, the idol worshippers, Arlei Lev, those who are uncircumcised of heart, they're not like that. Rather, they store up, they guard their anger eternally. They can't forgive. And he says, it's said in reference to the Gevonim, that since they did not mochel, they did not forgive, and they were not appeased. So it says concerning them, "Va'givonim lo b'nei Yisrael hema," that the givonim were not of the Jewish people, to indicate not just that they weren't Jewish, but that they partook of a very serious defect. So this is a very significant aspect of perfection. I would add that it's a very significant aspect of happiness in general. That this particular ideal is not just ethical and a virtue, but it is the hallmark of an individual who has the capacity to have a happy kind of life. Because people that are completely consumed with offenses against their dignity and a tremendous amount of energy that goes into the whole situation of their narcissism and how people treat them and whether they're getting the proper respect. If they're too consumed by that, then it kind of makes it impossible to have any kind of happy life, because you're always, these types of things are always happening, and a tremendous amount of energy is going to be drained in that whole situation as to whether you're being treated properly or improperly, and then you have to harbor hatred, and all these things weigh down on a person and really make it impossible for them to put their energy where it ought to be in the pursuit of knowledge. A person whose energy is in the right place has a tremendous protection, because to the extent that you're in the world of what's real and what's important and what counts, to that extent you see how ridiculous and petty are the things that tend to bother the average person.